Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor. What's gone wrong with British politics? Most people would tell you it's the fault of the young. Left-wing teachers turning out left-wing students who sit there chanting, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn," as their messiah takes to the stage. But a new report from the Legatum Institute suggests that we've got it exactly wrong. In fact, it's so much worse than any Conservatives thought. The views of the Corbynites, the view that capitalism is bad, that public ownership is good, are in fact entrenched right across society. I'm joined by the authors of this new report, Matthew Ellis and James Kanagasorium, to talk about just why things have gone so wrong.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hi there.
So, Matthew, you are, of course, the founder of the Taxpayers Alliance and the CEO of Vote Leave, so therefore the man who brought us Brexit. And James is a senior analyst at Populous, the research company who have actually carried out this research. So let me start by reading you something you say sort of quite early on, which sort of really did strike me. We find that on almost every issue, the public tends to favour non-free market ideals rather than those of the free market. Instead of an unregulated economy, the public favour regulation. Instead of companies striving for profit, they want businesses to be socially responsible. Instead of privatised water, electricity, gas and railway sectors, they want public ownership. The capitalism brand is in crisis. It is seen as selfish, greedy and corrupt. And it compares negatively to public association with liberalism, socialism, and indeed patriotism. So what prompted you to actually look into this stuff in the first place?
Well, it's really the general election. And of course, you know, nobody's really fully expecting the result that came out of it with the hung parliament. And after that, we felt as an institute, we really need to actually understand, you know, what the public were thinking. You know, it's very easy to write up the election campaign as being solely about perhaps the manifesto or the Conservative Party machine or how the grassroots worked. But I think you also actually need to look at where public opinion is at the moment. So we commissioned Populous to do this landscape poll for us to actually really work out, you know, where do the public stand on all sorts of issues? You know, what sort of public are we dealing with? Now, at the Legatum Institute, we are big believers that in taking people from the path from poverty right through to prosperity. And we believe that key aspects of that are entrepreneurship, you know, competition, free trade, these sort of free enterprise ideas. So we need to actually know, you know, are these ideas popular in the UK? Where do we stand with the public in this sort of post-Brexit, post-election atmosphere?
Yes, and I should have said you're actually now a senior fellow at Legatum one of your many hats.
Yeah.
And what you found, well, I mean, I've got the thing in front of me that, you know, capitalism is seen as, is associated with the words greedy, corruptive, greedy, corrupt, selfish, dangerous, divisive, and that this holds true pretty much across society and across age groups.
It very much does. And I think it's important to realise it's not just the word capitalism. I think we need to say, okay,
that was going to be one of my questions. Can't we just call it, you know, schmapitalism?
Exactly. Think of a new word. You know, will it change what people think? No, we did, you know, dozens of questions in this poll to actually look at all sorts of different aspects of public policy. And generally speaking, James will be able to speak more to this than I can. Generally speaking, you know, people preferred the state interventionist regulatory side of the spectrum rather than the free enterprise, you know, low taxes, low regulation side of things.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We were wary that in polling just the word capitalism, whether that was just an artifact rather than a kind of substantive fact that people are actually getting quite negative towards kind of free market, open market ideals. So we very carefully broke out all the different components, as it were, of a free enterprise. So again, we were looking at CEO pay, for example, and wage caps, regulation, the issue of 0 hours contracts, worker representation on boards, home ownership, how people view profit. And what was very striking is that on all these components, there was the weight of public opinion was definitely away from the free market or the open market. And perhaps really only on the issue of austerity and public spending were the public opinion broadly in the middle.
Well, I think that ties into one of the findings of the report, isn't it? That where the conservative, the traditional conservative message still resonates is on the sort of more authoritarian side. It's on the, so people are, and in fact, there's a fascinating chart in your thing, which shows the Brexit vote was, it was not determined by economics, that people's attitudes about economics, they're sort of spread across the thing, but there's a really clear divide between people who are socially authoritarian and socially liberal.
That's exactly right. There's a part of the report where effectively we create two components out of people's responses to a number of questions, and one of those is a kind of social liberal index and the other one is a kind of economic index. And actually what we discovered is that these run across each other, they're not related. And what that means is effectively when we're looking at something like the Brexit vote or in fact a whole host of other issues,
welfare
or perhaps immigration or in fact views on jail and things like that, we see that people's opinions broadly break across the social liberal line that's very strongly correlated to age and levels of education. What was really fascinating, though, this report is about primarily about capitalism and open markets. And what was very interesting there is that instead of opinion perhaps getting, as it were, more free market as you got older, what we discovered is that across the piece, young to old, if they couldn't find unity over Brexit, they certainly did over the issue of open markets.
Yeah, so let's take an example here. I mean, public support for nationalising trains. Now, it's 76% of the public like that idea. It's 76% of 18 to 34-year-olds. It's 76% of those over 35. It's 86% of Labour voters, but it's 65% of Conservative voters. You know, there is not a segment of the public crying out in defence of Southern Rail.
Exactly. And when people, if you look back to the election, I remember different politicians talking about, Jeremy Corbyn's nationalisation programme and taking us back to the 80s and how this would be a terrible thing.
Well, the 70s.
Whereas, 70s even. Whereas, as we now see from this research, actually some people would have heard what he was talking about nationalisation. They actually, I rather like the idea of that.
Yeah, so, because it's not just about the utilities, is it? You say that 50% of the public favour and oppose nationalising the banks, and you can actually find takers for pretty much nationalising pretty much anything from travel agents to internet companies.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you've got Conservative voters, 2017 Conservative voters, who as a majority support the nationalisation of water, electricity, gas, and railway, and it shows that those what the Conservative Party thought as quite potent arguments, that the Labour Party was stuck in a time war, where it was in fact the opposite. They just simply reminded a lot of people that the Conservatives were perhaps quite far away from the centre of opinion on economic issues.
I suppose the argument has always been, as it was with Ed Miliband, and actually Michael Howard, each individual policy can be popular, but when you put them together and put a certain badge on it, then people sort of suddenly go, oh.
And it's fair to say that if you look at, James have the exact stats on this, but it's not in this poll, if you look at overall economic competence, I think it's fair to say the Conservatives are still ahead of Labour on that issue.
Yes, that's exactly right. But I think over the issue where I think the Conservatives may have fallen short in terms of the economy is over the issue of motives. So yes, people believe that they were competent, and I think that's very strongly related to views on austerity, which is a lot of people still think that government spending can't run out of control. But there were issues over, as it were, economic motives, people questioning why the Conservatives were coming up with the policies that they were. I mean, I saw a statistic that something like 69% of Labour voters in 2017 opted for the party because they trusted in the motives of the party. And that figure was a lot lower for the Conservative Party.
And I guess one of the questions is how, which is, it's hard to tell from this research, but you may have an idea from other stuff, is what sort of timescale are we looking at from this? Is it a sudden thing or is it something which is developed gradually?
No, this isn't a sudden thing. We tried to make that quite clear in the report. What we're not saying is that public opinion has taken a sharp turn to the left. I think what we're seeing now is a delayed reaction and a delayed realization that actually public opinion on economic matters is quite a lot further to the left than we realized. So, for example, the British Social Attitudes Survey, which comes out every year, tracks how people think the balance is between government spending and tax, and whether they would like spending to rise and tax to rise, or spending to fall and tax to fall. And actually, we're not at historic highs. Under the Labour government, particularly in the midpoint at around 2005 to 2006, there was actually more support for government spending than there is now. I think what we're seeing, though, is the gap between the commentariat and where the public opinion is.
And partly that's about austerity or perception of austerity. That's about the financial crisis, real wages, all the...
It's not just perception of austerity, actually. I've been looking into the statistics on this, and actually beliefs about whether tax rises should occur or not is very strongly aligned with the percentage of public spending as GDP. And they track each other perfectly. And public spending as a percentage of GDP is now around 40%, which is quite a bit lower than it was some 4 or 5 years ago, even though, of course, public debt is going up and there is still a deficit. Mm. But the point is that tolerance for less spending proportionally is waning. Precisely, probably, I would argue, at the moment where we still need, as it were, limits over that.
Yeah, and this is actually something John Curtis talked about with us on CapEx a few months ago. The idea that it's always cyclical, that, you know, there's a sort of homeostasis going on. What would be your sort of your suggested response to this? So I'm really interested that Matthew is the author of this and is here with us, because there's something you and I have discussed in private, which I'm glad I've got you here, because I've been so tempted to use it as my own line. So I can at last now attribute it to its author, which is that everyone says that Brexit, which you helped bring about, was a right-wing phenomenon. That's how it's seen. The evil Tories are doing evil things to the country in pursuit of their evil free market ambitions. I mean, the point you've made is that actually Brexit was won on a left-wing perspective. It was won on this report's perspective. You know, your message was not, we will save 350 million a week and use it to give everyone a tax cut. It was, we will take 350 million a week and spend it on the NHS.
That is very true. You know, there are all sorts of reasons why people voted Leave. You know, many people were attracted by the sovereignty argument and taking back control and issues like that. You know, there were some people who were interested in the migration argument too. But when you look at the what we had on the side of the bus, and like you're saying, you know, we spend £350 million a week.
Which, by the way, I oppose utterly as a statistic, and we've had this argument before.
We've had the argument before. But in a sense, that was a message on the left. But I think the Brexit victory was seen to be a result for the right, a win for the right. So fast forwarding by a year to the general election, in a sense, perhaps people shouldn't be so surprised about the result.
I would agree absolutely with Matthew. I mean, some commentators have got the term Lexit, you know, left-wing Brexit. And I think, you know, this isn't a discussion over Brexit, but, you know, a lot of things were very deliberately positioned for centre-left voters. So, you know, you had red logos, you know, Gisela Stewart fronting the campaign, using the NHS logo. These were all triggers for voters who are perhaps on the economic left.
And in fact, your very first launch video, which featured sort of hospitals turning into pound notes and fluttering away to Brussels. You were sort of saying, you know, there was this whole list of things we could spend this money on, and then a sort of apologetic cough and or tax cuts. And, you know, it was like we could help the NHS, we could build high speed rail, we could make our schools cathedrals, or you know.
I think this because Matthew realised, I think, where the kind of centre ground of public opinion is. I mean, there's been a lot of conversation about where is the centre ground. And, you know, my view is on social issues, it actually is probably quite a bit further to the right than many commentators have realised.
Although it's interesting that now gay marriage seems to be completely accepted. There's a 20% lead on that in your work.
Exactly, yeah. But issues like that aside, I think the public opinion on social issues is quite a lot further to the right than many people realise, and actually on economic issues, much further to the left. And in fact, the kind of consensus, you know, we talk about it a bit in the report, but the kind of Blairite, New Deal, Clinton-esque centrist consensus of kind of open markets and social liberalism, you know, that, you know, personally, that's what I support. But actually, I think it's not particularly a very popular view at the minute.
So we've been speaking up until now as though the public is sort of homogenous, that there is public opinion, like a kind of there is something out there that we can capture. But that's obviously not the case. You know, as our discussion just now on £350 million showed, you know, that people are different and they believe different things and they react different ways to different messages. And so one of the other things you've done in this report is break down the country. I mean, was this just the UK? The UK is, or just England? By the way,
This is a UK electorate. Yeah. So we broke out the UK population rather than electorates into five groups using a kind of segmentation process called latent class analysis. It's a kind of industry standard way of basically separating out a population based on attitudinal similarities.
So you're basically finding clusters of opinions which correlate to each other.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And yes, and so what were your findings?
I think, well, first of all, there were five groups, and I think with statistical procedures like this, actually they turn out to be more of an art than a science. I mean, there's any number of ways that you can cut the UK population into 5, 6, 7, 8, doesn't matter. But I think what we found were, again, very interesting groups of people that differed quite widely on both the economic spectrum and the social spectrum. And the key point here is that if economic views and social views are unrelated, then actually it's possible to have a huge number of combinations of opinions on those things. And that's kind of what the segmentation brings out. So we have, for example, there's a group called Left Behind, which is a kind of a small segment around, I think, 7%, which consists of predominantly Leave voters, but also extremely economically left-wing voters. These voters, for example, may not have a party that naturally fits their views, but they are definitely a segment of the population. You know, that's more like Die Linke, for example, in Germany. And then we also have cosmopolitan critics. You'll have to excuse the names. But that's 16% of the population. Perhaps an archetype that we're all quite familiar with. London, left-leaning, Remain-leaning, extremely socially liberal, but also very far left on economic issues. And then, of course, we have three bigger segments. So we have every segmentation always has a middle group that's called disengaged something, because there are a very large number of people that are disengaged. And we have disengaged pessimists who broadly are in the middle on a lot of issues, but not particularly engaged with them. And then we have optimistic centrists, which are people that are broadly, but not completely, free market. And that's about 29% of the population. And perhaps more right-leaning, you know, the kind of David Cameron.
Yeah,
archetype.
I was going to say Cameron voters. Yeah,
exactly. And then right of centre traditionalists. This is, I would put this as the kind of Liam Fox, I think, archetype of voter, which is quite far to the right on social issues, very far to the right on economic ones. I think they were the only segment, correct me if I'm wrong, Matthew, that were quite strongly in favour of free market ideals across the different components that we were looking at.
Yes, though even they would want to nationalise the water companies.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of really shocking thing, that even when you break out the population into pro or anti open market on that kind of spectrum, you still find support for nationalisation across a lot of key industries and even the most kind of economically, you know, right-wing segments. I mean, this is the thing. Even in home territory, for those of us that support open markets, the consensus for all that is very, very weak.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
What the hell do you do about it? Because this isn't just about saying, oh yes, well, you know, this is what the public believes, so government should believe it too, which is, you know, quite, you know, what politicians are often accused of. I mean, all three of us, I think, would genuinely would say, and we could point to stacks of evidence for this, that, you know, open, liberal, free market economies are the best way to go. And you can differ about, you know, the level of government intervention there, the level of government investment, you know, but broadly speaking, what has delivered prosperity to an awful lot of people around the world and in this country as well is the kind of the ideas we're talking about. So what do you do? Is this opinion, is there a magic bullet to try to explain that to people? Is it a case of getting into government and then trying to do as much of it as you can without upsetting people? Or do you just go, you know what, we have to deal with the electorate as it is?
I think we've got to start making the case again. And we had, you know, spectacularly good timing for this report, in the sense that, you know, Theresa May has done a speech in the Bank of England, you know, celebrating free enterprise and job creation and wealth creation and, you know, all the principles we talk about in this report. And I think having politicians to make that case is incredibly important, because, you know, when you have, you know, early this week, you know, John McDonnell in his speech talking about nationalisation and talking about PFI and issues like that, we know from this research some of those ideas are incredibly popular. But then when he talked about how they'd started wargaming, about how it might lead to a run on the pound and what they'd do about that, we've got to start making the case by pointing out the effect of these policies. And I think that will help bring people our way. I think the second point is that we shouldn't fall into the trap of automatically always defending the status quo. So if they're saying you should nationalise certain things, we shouldn't base our case around the fact that all the privatised industries at the moment are running perfectly and brilliantly and shouldn't be changed in any way.
And besides, they've given a very large cheque to help us have a nice fringe meeting at Conservative Party conference.
Right. We need to actually sort of look at these industries, actually work out which ones are working well, which ones are too monopolistic, you know, which ones can we introduce more competition to. And I think this will be sort of stage two of the research, working out how can we make the case for free enterprise better. We need to think about, you know, sketch an idea. There are certain aspects of business which are very monopolistic. So the big businesses, some of the ones which rely on regulation to enforce their position, versus the elements of business that nobody has a problem with in the country, the more, you know, the SMEs, the entrepreneurs, the people who've mortgaged their home to set up a business, and try and sort of disaggregate the two.
It's funny, when I think about, you know, how do we move the dial on this? Because the dial needs to be moved quite a long way. I always think of the old anecdote, you know, don't tell me you're funny, tell me a joke. And I think in the case of open markets and free enterprise. The government needs to do that. I think the case can be made, but I'm not sure that copies of Hayek and talking about the Laffer curve will move the dial on this. I think what needs to happen is actual policies enacted. I think, you know, it's been said before, but home ownership is key and was one of the cornerstones of Margaret Thatcher's, as it were, conversion of a lot of middle England social conservatives to open markets.
So, you've written for us on CapEx before about I've written it, but based on our discussions about how home ownership is one of the things that kind of inexorably converts people into a Tory. If you've got a nice house, if you're living in a nice job, and you're living in the suburbs, then you know you sort of find yourself slowly putting the kind of Jeremy Corbyn T-shirts further and further back in the wardrobe.
Yeah, they get put up in the attic, and the picket fence goes up. I mean, it's voting Tory is quite often associated with a number of markers, which I think your article discusses. Marriage, perhaps moving out to the suburbs, owning your own house. And frankly, often when we hear conservative politicians, you know, they talk in the language of consultations and white papers. The thing about Jeremy Corbyn is that he speaks in very plain English. Yes, there might be questions over the costings. Yes, there might be questions over delivery and procedural things. But actually, his ambitions are high. And I think what I think could move the dial is a conservative party and perhaps even a Liberal Democrat party that sets its ambitions extremely high and starts speaking in plain, clear language about house building.
And so one interesting angle to your research or Matthew's work at Legatum is it's not just about the UK. You're sort of researching populism worldwide. And in fact, you... I apologize for bringing this up, but your last appearance on CapEx was to reassure us that the Germans were solid, sensible, and prosperous, and and we could expect no shocks and surprises in their election, which they then promptly ignored your sage advice and voted for AfD.
It was interesting. I went back to my research after the result, and actually, I think what I said stacked up. I think Merkel polled less than we thought she would, and AfD got slightly more than we thought they would. We went back to the polling, and actually, if you look at some of these international polls, you'll notice from your work at Populous, often they're sort of several months out of date once they've all been collated together. And so the polling we had comparing attitudes towards globalization in Germany, UK, France, Netherlands was from a June 2017 paper. And I'm guessing the polling was probably done in the early part of the year. So I think things are changing in Germany.
I haven't commented on or looked at the German election, but what I will say is that the fact that it was a surprise, I think, says a lot, not only about the result, but actually media coverage. I mean, the results were not far off. They were a standard deviation out from poll estimates. I mean, politics is a probability game, not a certainty game. So I think a lot of it was people had assumed that Merkel was going to win and win comfortably, and that was actually disjunct from the fact that from what the numbers were saying, which was if you flex things a few points here and there, and particularly with the German system.
But I mean, this is an interesting sort of digression. But given you're in polling, it's, you know, we went through a stage where the polls just got it wrong, election after election, and that led to sort of an incredible suspicion of the polls. And now we've actually just been through a sequence of events where the polls actually got it right, but they were so contrary to received wisdom about what could possibly happen, viz. Brexit, viz. Trump, Germany, and actually, you know, Corbyn versus May, that everyone went, oh, no, you know, it's problems with the model.
Well, my view on this is that polls are one tool of many that people use to forecast elections. I mean, I was reading Hillary Clinton's new biography, and she talks about, in the American system, a tripartite kind of research program. Polls is one thing. Data analytics and data science is the second, and focus groups is the third. And, you know, those are keys, as it were, that help you unlock the public opinion at large. I think over here in the UK, we have a slight obsession with the first, which is simply polls that come out, with very little attention.
They're easy headlines.
Easy headlines, exactly. And free, and it's easier media consumption. And there's, you can ignore things like margin of error and get a good story out of it. But actually, it's the data science, it's the data analytics, and actually the qualitative stuff, sitting down, doing a focus group, listening to what people are saying, that is just as insightful. But again, it's not, those aren't things that commentators or large parts of the media would have access to.
Yes, I mean, I remember during an election campaign being offered the chance to do a focus group and then being told it would be £20,000. Thank you very much. It's like, well, yeah, I don't think we can afford that. But I suppose what I was getting at here is that it's not just a UK problem, is it? This sort of disillusionment with the system as it stands.
I think we're going into a new phase of politics. We talked earlier about the 1980s and Thatcherism, and of course you had Reagan at the same time, and people like Roger Douglas in New Zealand. Then you moved into the mid 90s, and you had Tony Blair in the UK and Bill Clinton in America, and people like Gerhard Schroeder in Germany. Then you that basically, I'd say, continued in a sense, that third way approach, generally speaking, until the latest phase, which is, I'm not quite sure I would define it yet. Is it the rise of populism, or is it an anti-establishment feeling, or is it definitely sort of Brexit in the UK, but also there's a left-wing populist element to it?
I think if you take the economic and social spectrums, I think what we're seeing here is the consensus move to the left on economic issues from where it was. I mean, but Bill Clinton and his New Deal, that's him introducing market reforms now, which the Conservatives would be nervous about. And then I guess on the social spectrum, you've got movements to the right, a newfound skepticism and acknowledgement over immigration issues that were simply not around. I mean, do you remember Michael Howard's general election campaign, 2005? He was derided for his "Are you thinking what we're thinking?" posters. Whereas I think we live in a world now where he wouldn't necessarily be derided for that.
But there's an interesting element here. You mentioned a sort of political structure in Germany. So there's a case that the Republicans in the US were out of step with their base, and Trump basically ran away with them because he was saying all the things which were heresy to people who'd been reading Hayek and Milton Friedman, but actually sounded like solid good sense to the US electorate. Whereas in the UK, the logical move would be for a Tory basically to ditch all the free market stuff and be run as a sort of, run as a sort of an authoritarian protective figure, which may sort of came close to you, but the structure of the Conservative Party means those kind of people can't get to the top of it.
I see it differently. I see the move as being one about where you position yourselves. Are you part of the establishment like Hillary Clinton was, or Angela Merkel,
or the Remain campaign,
or are you an outsider? Are you running outside the Beltway, to use a US term, or outside of SW1, on the side of the people? And actually, a classic definition of populism is basically people who run on the side of the people and use that rhetoric in their campaigns. And that's why you get populists on the right and those on the left, like Mélenchon, or you mentioned the left in Germany, or the green left in the Netherlands, or Bernie Sanders in the US. So it's left-wing populist phenomenon. So really, I think it's more about where you position yourselves.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think what Matthew's been able to exploit quite well in his kind of campaigning career so far, you're running out of referendums to run, is the status quo.
There's the one on whether we go back in.
That's for another day. is this concept of status quo? I don't think you've ever run a campaign where you've tried to defend the status quo. It's always been about change.
No, maybe.
Well, no, but I think what you were saying is that we'll fund if don't introduce these charges, otherwise we can't fund. You had that famous advert. You can't fund the midwife. And that's all. Yeah.
And I think, but actually, you were anti-status quo. If you defined the coalition as the status quo, your whole message was basically, this will guarantee Nick Clegg is always in Downing Street.
Absolutely, you had managed to paint people arguing for proportional AV as somehow establishment when they almost definitely were not.
It wasn't difficult.
Exactly. But I think that's an interesting and very much an alternative model to what you were saying about Donald Trump. What did he do differently? I mean, we shouldn't forget he lost the popular vote. Hillary Clinton won the second most votes anyone's ever won in a US presidential election. It was just a very badly distributed vote. So there's been a lot of hand-wringing, I think, about that and that loss and how it's the collapse of the American establishment. And I think it is important not to go completely overboard. I mean, what a trend I've spotted often, I think, I've only been doing working in and around politics since 2014. And before then, I worked in the city. And one of the things that really struck me is that people always seem to be fighting the last war and applying the lessons of the previous campaign and using that as a lens for the next one. So again, when David Cameron won in 2015, I think a lot of people, you know, myself included, thought, okay, that's about solid centrism and leadership being the order of the day. And you come to the 2016 referendum and that's ripped up. And suddenly it's about change and it's about populism. It's about taking back control. It's about sovereignty. And then we get to 2017 and we're thinking, Leave had a huge geographic advantage over Remain in terms of how its vote was distributed. And everyone thought the consensus was, well, of course the Conservatives are going to win. UKIP were at 14% and they're now down at 5%, and all those extra votes will deliver loads of seats. And turns out that's wrong as well. So I think we've got to be really careful here about extrapolating a new model of politics for the fourth time in 4 years and moving forward with that.
So one final question, I guess, which echoes something I asked before. Can the British be brought to love the free market again? Or if they ever did?
I think they can, and this will be the next stage of the project. We've diagnosed where public opinion is at the moment. Now we need to work out the arguments and messages that really resonate with people. And I think they're there. Just going back to John McDonnell's speech again, you know, it all sounded very good when he was talking about nationalisation to people, but people don't want the run on the pound. We need to actually explain to people what the outcomes of the Labour Party's very left-wing populist policies would be.
I think I'm perhaps a little less hopeful than Matthew. I think the strongest case for the free market and open markets will be a Corbyn government, because I think, you know, the last time that, you know, what led to a kind of backlash and the promotion of free markets was, of course, the winter of discontent. It took physical evidence of economic mismanagement and bad policies for people to realise. I think it's very hard to demonstrate the complex benefits of open markets without there being evidence to the contrary. And I think we may be going through a phase where maybe Corbyn gets elected next time, maybe he doesn't, we don't know. But if he does, I think that will be the clearest and most strong argument for free markets.
Yes, although as with Trump, there's then that question of at what point his supporters will just yell that it's a conspiracy and that he was never given a fair chance. And of course, it was, you know.
Speaking from a personal perspective, my dad remembers 1979, the winter of discontent, where, you know, the family politics flipped from Labour to Conservative overnight. And that was a permanent shift. And you can see from the data and the statistics that overnight a cohort and generation of people became Conservative,
and stayed Conservative
and got more Conservative. And actually what we're seeing now, actually with a lot of the older people, is a cohort of people that are uniquely pro-Conservative. And I think, personally, I think there's a lot of work to do, a lot of research to do. But I think it's going to be a Corbyn government that moves the needle the most on this.
Matthew, James, thank you very much.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.